Headlines this hour, China issues yet another warning to the U.S. over Taiwan, saying that it will fight back every provocation by Washington that undermines its sovereignty. Fremont says it has received the first data from remote sensing Khayyam satellite hours after it was launched into space aboard a Russian Soyuz rocket. And former U.S. President Donald Trump is facing questioning under oath over his family's business practices 2 days after the FBI's raid on his residence in Florida.
Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Muse. Thanks for joining us.
China vows that it will fight back every U.S. provocation that undermines its sovereignty.
Every time the U.S. side makes a serious provocative act of infringing on China's sovereignty and interfering in China's internal affairs, the Chinese side will resolutely fight back. China will never allow its sovereignty and territorial integrity to be wantonly trampled on and sabotaged.
The foreign ministry spokesman issued the warning amid rising tensions over a recent controversial visit by the U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to Taiwan. After her trip, Pelosi said that Washington would not allow China to isolate the self-ruled island. Wang described the trip as a major political provocation aimed at upgrading U.S.-Taiwan exchanges. He noted that Beijing had warned the U.S. that the visit would harm bilateral ties. He once again urged Washington to uphold the One China principle and to avoid using Taiwan to contain the country. China claims that Taiwan as its own territory and has repeatedly warned against the island's growing nexus with the U.S. Earlier today, Beijing also vowed zero tolerance for separatist activities on the island, as both sides engaged in separate military drills in a show of strength. We've talked to political commentator Said Mustafa Hoshesham about growing tensions between the U.S. and China over Taiwan. He believes the U.S. tries to bully all countries, including China, which it regards as enemies.
Americans deal with all their foes and rivals the same way. They try to bully and humiliate all those rivals and the states that are called as rogue states or enemy states, whatever they call. They try to humiliate and bully them. It doesn't make any difference if you're China, if you're Iran, if you're Russia. They try to impose their will on you, and be it in the negotiations over the war of tariff between the United States and China, or territorial integrity of China. It doesn't make any difference. The tactics they've been using against East European countries when they staged Velvet Revolutions were again repeated in Baghdad, embassy of the United States. The same was done in Hong Kong. And the same thing that they've been doing to all other enemies, they are now doing to China in Taiwan. It's not just the Biden administration or Nancy Pelosi. Under Donald Trump, the same strategy was underway, and they have continued the same kind of humiliation and the same kind of bullying tactics against Chinese.
The Iranian Ministry of Information and Communications says it has received the first data from the Khayyam satellite hours after it was launched into space from a base in Kazakhstan. The ministry says the data was received at the Iranian Space Agency's Mahdash base. Khayyam, aboard a Russian Soyuz rocket, was blasted off from Baikonur Cosmodrome on Tuesday. The remote sensing satellite can send space images with a resolution accuracy of 1 meter. President Ibrahim Raisi has hailed the successful launch of the satellite, calling it a moment of pride. Raisi says that Iran will benefit from more advances in the aerospace field, which will be helpful for various areas such as the environment, as well as in monitoring the country's borders. Meanwhile, the head of the Iranian Space Agency has dismissed as childish claims by Washington that the satellite is for spying purposes. Following the launch, the U.S. expressed anger at Iran's partnership with Russia and leveled an accusation that the satellite is aimed at spying. A Palestinian man has died of wounds that he sustained during Israeli strikes in the besieged Gaza Strip during the weekend. The man was critically injured after Israeli missiles hit a residential neighborhood in the city of Beit Hanun. His death brings to 47 the number of Gazans killed during the three-day Israeli assault on the besieged territory. 4 women and 16 children are among the dead, while some 360 people were wounded. In response to Israel's attacks, the Islamic Jihad resistance movement fired hundreds of rockets at Israeli cities, including Tel Aviv, Sderot, and Ashkelon. Egypt brokered truce ended the latest bout of Israeli strikes on Gaza. 4 Palestinians have been killed in the occupied West Bank. Israeli military killed 3 Palestinians, including a fighter and a member of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, Ibrahim al-Nablusi, in Nablus. A 4th Palestinian was killed during a protest in Khalil. Mona Kandil reports.
Israeli forces have assassinated Ibrahim al-Nablusi, a resistance fighter and commander of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. Israeli troops raided Nablus early Tuesday and surrounded a building in the old city, where al-Nablusi had barricaded himself in. A gunfight lasted for several hours with Israeli forces even firing anti-tank missiles at the building. 32-year-old Islam Sabouh and 16-year-old teen Hussein Jamal Taha were also killed in the raid. At least 60 Palestinians were wounded, according to the Palestinian Health Ministry.
We have not witnessed such an aggressive raid to Nablus in years. The aim was to assassinate al-Nablusi and any other Palestinian who was assisting him. He refused to surrender and clashed with the soldiers for hours and was finally martyred.
As the raid started, we rushed to the old town, but the soldiers had blocked the neighborhood. They opened fire at us. We tried to evacuate the wounded, including a woman, but they continued shooting at us. Dozens were wounded as a result.
Israeli Prime Minister Yair Lapid has reacted to Nablus operation, saying that the killing of whom he described as terrorist Ibrahim Nablusi was another step in Israel's uncompromising fight against terrorism.
This cell has been worrying Israeli military. They carried out a number of shooting against Israeli soldiers and settlers. That is why the Israeli military wanted to strike them and kill one of its leaders.
A number of West Bank cities, including Ramallah and Al-Khalil, observed commercial strikes as part of a period of mourning and in protest at the killings in Nablus. The regime forces clashed with the protesters in Al-Khalil and shot dead at least one Palestinian. It has become clear that Israel is targeting any Palestinian who is honored as a real fighter. The regime might succeed in assassinating those fighters like Ibrahim al-Nablusi, but they would even be remembered as heroes and icons who devoted their lives to fighting Israeli soldiers. Mona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
The former U.S. President Donald Trump has faced tough questions under oath before the New York State Attorney General in a civil investigation into his family business practices. The Office of Attorney General Letitia James has been gathering documents on the case for 3 years. Trump is being investigated for allegedly inflating his real estate and other asset values. James says her probe uncovered significant evidence that the Trump Organization overstated asset values to obtain favorable loans and to evade paying taxes. The former president has declined any wrongdoing, calling the probe a politically motivated witch hunt. In a statement, Trump said that he even declined to respond to questions before the attorney general under his constitutional rights. Meanwhile, he is also being investigated for taking sensitive documents while leaving the White House. On Monday, the FBI searched Trump's residence in Florida and seized important files. The U.S. says it has sent anti-radar missiles to Ukraine to help it target Russia's radar systems in the ongoing war between the two neighbors. The Pentagon says the missiles are the high-speed anti-radiation missile, or HARM, and were included in the $1 billion in additional military aid package for Kiev. There's no mention of the exact number, but it is the first time the Defense Department has revealed sending the previously undisclosed missile to Ukraine. Ukrainian authorities have not publicly acknowledged receiving or using HARMs. But in recent days, some reports have shown the remains of what appear to be the fin of a HARM missile that targeted a Russian position in Ukraine. The U.S. has sent $9.8 billion in military aid to Kiev since the launch of Russia's military offensive there in February.
The war in Ukraine has caused enormous distress to the civilian population in the war-stricken areas. Ukraine and Russia have accused each other of endangering the lives of civilians. A report by Amnesty International, which is a Western rights group and is biased towards Western-style liberal democracies, has now accused Ukraine of flouting international law by exposing civilians to Russian fire. The report accuses the Ukrainian military of having established its bases in schools and hospitals. It says the Ukrainian military has launched counterattacks from heavily populated areas.
So the West is actively shaping the narrative, and it's also realizing that the narrative that the West has been provoking through Ukraine, that Ukraine has been regurgitating, is becoming increasingly seen as absolutely false. There's no facts or truth behind any of the words or the ideas or the images that the U.S. narrative has been trying to communicate. Specifically, the Russians are not losing, the Russians are not retreating.
As it was expected, the report angered Ukrainian officials. In reaction to Kiev's objection, Amnesty has issued a statement expressing its regret for the, quote, distress and anger that the report has caused amongst Ukrainian officials. Amnesty has, however, said that it stands by its findings. It has noted that the evidence it has documented does not justify, quote, Russia's violations. The blame game comes amid intensified efforts by the United States to keep the war going in East Ukraine.
Well, I think the grotesque blundering and failure of the United States in Ukraine has been ongoing for a long, long time, of course, ever since 2009 to 2019. The United States has been involved with funding illegal global viral biological chemical labs. It's been involved with training Ukrainian soldiers, inspiring them to commit acts of genocide. The U.S. has been behind all of the Ukrainian madness for a long time.
The U.S. has been the largest contributor of weapons to Ukraine by far. Ironically, other NATO members who have supplied Ukraine with weapons, like Germany, for instance, had actually purchased their weapons from American arms manufacturers. And where those unaccounted weapons actually end up? Well, according to Interpol, many weapons will end up on the black market and in the hands of criminals.
The Biden administration has just announced a $1 billion arms and weapons package for Ukraine. That's the largest military installment to Ukraine since the war began in February. The upcoming military package is the 18th such tranche and brings U.S. commitment to about $9.8 billion. The package consists of HIMARS systems, 75,000 rounds of 155mm artillery ammunition, mortar systems, and 20,000 rounds and mortar ammunition, as well as munitions for National Advanced Surface-to-Air Missile Systems.
Most of these weapon systems are actively being manned and fired, and targeting is being done by U.S. Military and CIA forces, as well as British. But the Ukrainians are doing very, very little, except they're dying. So all of the weapons that the West has sent in there, I think, was initially done recklessly without any real consideration of what the military requirements are for training.
The HIMARS are designed to shoot a variety of missiles and have sat high on Ukrainian wish lists. The supply of arms and weapons to Ukraine comes amid reports that the weapons sent to Ukraine do not make it to the front lines. There are reports that only 30% of weapons sent to Ukraine actually end up in the hands of Ukrainians. Reports say the rest go missing.
And now, I think the irony is all of these weapons are simply being sold on the black market by various parties because they're unmanageable. Now, what you will see most likely as well are these weapon systems emerging in small conflicts in Europe, which could be all sorts of domestic insurrections. You could have criminal gangs using a lot of these weapons. So the real loser of all of these Western weapons from the United States that have been sent in is going to be Europe.
Just recently, U.S. news channel CBS was forced to partially retract a documentary in which it said that shipments of weapons to Ukraine from the U.S. had been going missing. The documentary had apparently angered officials in Ukraine. It now appears that warlords in Washington are committing the same mistake they did in Afghanistan and Syria.
I like the structural path we're on here. As long as we help Ukraine with the weapons they need and the economic support, they will fight to the last person.
The Washington regime has poured so much weapons and ammunition in those regions that wars will likely continue for years. Now Ukraine appears to be the next victim of Washington's warmongering machinery.
Colombia and Venezuela say that they are moving toward restoring bilateral relations just days after the new Colombian president, Gustavo Petro, took the oath of office. Petro said the two neighbors are now working on the normalization process, which also involves border reopening. During the campaign trail, the leftist leader repeatedly pledged to resume ties with Venezuela. Meanwhile, Venezuela's defense minister, Vladimir Padrino Lopez, said that Caracas plans to reestablish military ties with Bogota. Last month, the foreign ministers of the two countries met in a Venezuelan border city, where they expressed desires to reinstate ties at the ambassadorial level. Relations between the two South American neighbors were broken in 2019, after the then-Colombian President Iván Duque refused to recognize the re-election of his Venezuelan counterpart, Nicolas Maduro. A veteran Syrian politician has blasted the U.S. for stealing the country's natural resources.
The United States is currently occupying Syrian territories and plundering Syria's grain and oil resources. These actions of the United States are very shameful. Hence, we never trust anything the United States says, because what they say is seriously contrary to what they do.
Chauvin also condemned Washington's illegal military presence in Syria. She made the remarks as the latest data released by the Syrian Ministry of Oil and Mineral Resources showed that the U.S. has been plundering most of the oil produced in the country. The ministry says the U.S. and militant groups that it supports pillaged over 80% of daily oil production in the first half of 2022. Damascus considers the U.S. presence as an outright violation of its sovereignty. It has repeatedly deplored Washington for supporting armed groups and for stealing natural resources. The U.S. federal court has found a former Twitter manager guilty of spying for Saudi Arabia's royal family. Ahmed Abuama was convicted on six criminal charges, including fraud, money laundering, and conspiracy. He was hired by a close advisor to Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman for gaining access to personal information of Saudi dissidents. Prosecutors said that Abuama, dual U.S.-Lebanese citizen, received at least $300,000 for sharing private information of Twitter users. Also, Ali al-Zabara, a colleague of Abuama, was accused of accessing Twitter accounts on behalf of Saudi Arabia. He left the U.S. before being charged. Riyadh was accused of spying on the U.S. for the first time, with arrest and the indictment of Abuama in late 2019.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
The Israeli regime will continue to shed Palestinian blood for fun or for political gain or to consolidate its occupation, says Refaat Al-Arir, writer, in an article published under the heading, Without Consequences, Israeli regime will continue to murder Palestinians. Stay tuned for more. Amal is now 2 years old. No one ever gets used to being bombarded every year or so. The kids in particular live in constant fear, but it does become part of life. As the Israeli missiles rained down on Gaza City recently, Amal, 6, asked her mom, memories of last year's horror still fresh. Will there be another war? During the assault, the children, especially Lina, 9, and Amal, have been mostly quiet. Amal has tried to sleep and Lina lay down in the living room. At night, like most kids in Gaza, they shriek in fear each time they hear an explosion. A report published by Euromed found that about 91% of Palestinian children live in constant trauma and terror due to recurrent Israeli regime attacks. Nothing can prepare you for this. The Zionist regime has been bombarding Gaza ever since the Second Intifada. They never get used to the bombs, and they never know how to deal with the sheer terror and absolute Israeli regime savagery. No lies or hugs or sweets can calm the kids down. When the bombs fall, the kids will always shirk in utter fear. The lies that things will be all right and that these are fireworks no longer work. The Zionist regime had killed at least 30 Palestinians, including 2 Islamic Jihad leaders and a little girl, Ala Qadum, recently. Well over 250 Palestinians have been injured and several homes and buildings have been destroyed or damaged. The Zionist regime's pretext this time is as flimsy as can be. After detaining a senior Islamic Jihad leader in the occupied West Bank, the Zionist regime said it was engaged in a preemptive operation to stop alleged missile attacks before they start. This is like the Zionist regime's war on Gaza in May 2021 and its massive 2014 attack and the many escalations between them. And it brings back memories of the Israeli regime's bombing campaigns in 2012, in 2008 to 2009, 2006, and many others, several of which coincided with Israeli regime elections. Many Palestinians have seen countless of their loved ones murdered in their sleep, or when they were resting and generally minding their own business. If the Zionist regime will kill Palestinians, regardless of who they are or what they are doing, then many Palestinians believe, why not die fighting and defending their country? There is no one more determined or dangerous than a person who has nothing to lose. During the May 2021 aggression, according to Air Wars, in more than 70% of Israeli regime attacks that killed Palestinian civilians, there was no reports of any casualties from the resistance. In other words, civilians were the only victims. According to B'Tselem, an Israeli rights group, nearly two-thirds of more than 2,200 Palestinians the Zionist regime killed in Gaza in 2014 were civilians. Notice that such statistics usually count Palestinian civilian police or resistance fighters killed in their homes as they slept as militants, as they claim. Given these realities, many children, women, and the elderly are not collateral damage. Rather, they are the Zionist regime's main targets. Indeed, we understand that when the Zionist regime escalates against Palestinians, its political leaders not only receive more votes in elections, they receive more support from Western countries. With the Zionist regime's polls projecting Benjamin Netanyahu to win a majority of more than 60 seats in upcoming elections, the current interim coalition regime, considered to be moderate by many liberals in the West, must have thought a quick war on Gaza might appeal to Israeli regime's electorate. Palestinians have become accustomed to the Zionist regime's carnage when elections approach. Israeli regime leaders know the best way to win votes is to flex their muscles. Their problem, in other words, is not with Netanyahu or the Likud, but with the Israeli regime occupation itself. Yet it is wrong to assume Israeli regime kills Palestinians only when there are elections on the horizon. Israeli and Zionist militias have been massacring Palestinians for approximately 100 years now. The fake regime of Israel is not satisfied with anything but total victory for its colonial rule. Palestinians are not Ukrainians for the world to care about. They are not mostly blonde with blue eyes. They're not Jews. And for being the wrong sort of people, it seems they have to starve, to live in fear and terror, and die without any lifting a finger. The sweets and the kids' favorite pudding remain untouched. Lena and Amal cower against the walls of the living room. They refuse to eat or be entertained. There will be more Israeli regime wars and more Israeli regime massacres. Will the Zionist regime war criminals ever pay for their crimes? Will Arab countries rushing to normalize ties with the fake regime of Israel see it for what it is? An entity built on the violent dispossession and dislocation of Palestinians? Can grassroots organizations and free people, wherever there may be, put more pressure on their governments to boycott and hold the fake regime of Israel accountable? If not, the lies, little and big, will continue. The fake regime of Israel will continue to shed Palestinian blood for fun or for political gain, or to consolidate its occupation, or simply because it can.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Now let's listen to the speech of Sheikh Jafar Jafar.
I begin in the name of Allah, the most kind, the most merciful. It's due to that kindness and mercy that we have these opportunities where we gather In remembrance and glorification of him, Tabaraka wa Ta'ala, we then send our condolences to our 12th and living Imam, Al-Hujja, Ajjalallahu Ta'ala, Farajahu Sharif, and to each and every one of you, as we gather on this night to commemorate the Istishhad anniversary of our fourth Imam, Imam As-Sajjad, Zain al-Abideen, alayhima afdalu salatu wassalam. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad wa ajil farajahum. We pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that we each get an opportunity to go for the ziyarat of our Imam in Baqi, inshaAllah, and that we receive his shafa'at in the hereafter, inshaAllah. You know, it is impossible to separate Imam As-Sajjad alayhi salam from Karbala. And the way we remember and mourn is by remembering what he had to go through in Karbala. You know, my heart starts that when Imam alayhi salam, you know, comes back to the khaymah to bid farewell, one of the places he stops is the tent of Sajjad alayhi salam. I keep thinking, yeah, that Sajjad, who was coming in and out of consciousness because of his illness, that when he looked at his father, and when he saw his father bloodied, and when he saw his father with thirst on his lips, and when he saw that his father was bidding farewell, I wonder if at that moment Sajjad asked Aba Abdullah, Ya Abata, Aina Ammi Abbas? That where is my uncle Abbas? Aina Akhi Aliyun al-Akbar? Aina Akhi Qasim? I wonder if at that time Imam al-Hussein looked at him and says, Beta, even Aliyun al-Asghar is no longer. Wahad Sajjada. Wa Mazluma. We can only imagine again what happens after. You know, when he was asked, that remind me, O Sajjad, how you were taken from Karbala to Kufa and Kufa to Sham. What does Imam alayhi salam say? He says, they placed me on a lame camel without any saddles. And then they raised a standard and they kept the head of my father on the standard. And they had our women and children on lame animals without saddles or coverings. And there were guards everywhere. And they were ordered that whenever someone cries, that we were hit on the head with spears. This is how our Imam was taken from Karbala to Kufa and Kufa to Sham, constantly being hit. For what crime, O Sajjad? For the crime of crying for his father and the Imam of the time, Wa Husayna. You know, before they were taken out of Karbala, they were made to pass through the battleground. And this is when they saw the body of their loved ones laid out. The body is being decapitated. The body is laid without any ghusl and kafan. It is at this time that Zainab looks towards Sajjad and she says, oh, the reminder of my grandfather. Why do I see you struggling for life? It is like the soul of Sajjad was coming out. Sajjad says, what? Ya Ammati. Oh, my Aunt Zainab. How can I not be restless? How can I not risk my life when I see my master, when I see my brothers and uncles? They have fallen drenched in their own blood without anyone to care for them, while I am here and I cannot do anything to assist. This gham stayed with Sajjad, huh? This inability to do anything for his father at that moment. Imagine, just imagine, if you see your brother, if you see your father, if you see your children laid out, and there is nothing we can do for them. Wallahi, it reminds me
When Aliyun al-Akbar comes to Imam al-Husayn and he says to him, Ya Abata al-Atashu qad qatalani, that this thirst is killing me. You know the jawab of the Imam was what? The jawab was, my son, what you're saying to me is difficult to bear. It is difficult because I cannot fulfill it. Sajjad felt that same way. He could not fulfill it. But we say, Ya Sajjad, there is more you have to see after this. There is more difficulties you have to endure after this. You have to be taken to the courtyard of Yazid and see this mal'oon play with the stick on the teeth of... You have to be in the dungeons of Sham when a young 3-year-old child embraces the head of her father and kisses the lips of her father and then does not move. Oh Sajjad, you have to bury your sister in Sham. Oh Sajjad, you have to see your aunts and your sisters in chains and in prison. You know, it is said Abu Hamza al-Thamali comes to him and sees him crying. He says, Ila mataad al-buka sayyidi, till when will you cry these tears? The Imam alayhi salam says, yes, I know that death for us is ordinary, that shahadat is an honor. But he says, Ya Aba Hamza, have you ever heard of women from the family of Rasulullah being taken as prisoners in this way? He says, by God, every time I see my aunt Zainab, every time I see my sisters, I can see them running from one tent to the... running from one tent to the other as they tried to escape the fires. When the Imam alayhi salam was poisoned, and when the poison took over the life of our Imam, it is that Imam al-Baqir was giving ghusl on his father and he began to cry out loud. فَقِيلَ لَهُ مَا يُبْكِيكَ يَبْنَ رَسُولِ اللَّهِ, what makes you cry, oh the grandson of Rasulullah? He says what? He says, Abki li ara min athar al jami'a. He says, as I was doing ghusl on the body of my father, I saw the marks of where chains and shackles were placed on the body of our Imam. Every day the Imam would be reminded of what. فَسَيَعْلَمُ الَّذِينَ ظَلَمُوا وَيَّمُ انْقَلَبِ يَنْقَلِبُونَ.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
رَحِيمٌ كَرِيمٌ عَظِيمٌ عليم حليم حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد. صلي على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
The extradition, trial, and conviction of Julian Assange would have frightening ramifications for investigative journalism, says Marjorie Kahn, journalist, in an article published under the heading, Julian Assange is enduring unbearable persecution for exposing U.S. war crimes. Stay tuned for more. Ever since UK Home Secretary Priti Patel formally ordered the extradition of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange to the US last week, press freedom advocates around the world have been mobilizing. Assange Defense is organizing a national and international campaign to pressure US Attorney General Merrick Garland and Joe Biden to drop the extradition request and dismiss the charges against Assange. The stakes could not be higher. The charges against Assange, including 17 under the infamous Espionage Act, could result in 175 years in prison for the journalist who exposed U.S. war crimes. Last week, Assange's brother, filmmaker Gabriel Shipton, wrote in an email to Truthout, UK Home Secretary has decided today that any publisher who exposes national security information of an allied country may face extradition to 2 lifetimes in prison. Julian will appeal this decision, and this once-in-a-lifetime fight for freedom of the press continues. Assange indictment is based on WikiLeaks 2010 to 2011 disclosures of U.S. war crimes in Iraq, Afghanistan, and the military prison at Guantanamo. Those revelations included 400,000 field reports about the Iraq war, 15,000 unreported deaths of Iraqi civilians, and systematic rape, torture, and murder committed by U.S. forces. Handed over detainees to a notorious Iraqi torture squad. WikiLeaks also disclosed the war logs, which are 90,000 reports, are more civilian casualties by coalition forces than the U.S. military had admitted to in Afghanistan. And its revelations additionally included the Guantanamo files, 779 secret reports showing that 150 innocent people had been held there for years, and documenting the torture and abuse of 800 men and boys in violation of the Geneva Conventions and the Convention Against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman, and Degrading Treatment or Punishment. WikiLeaks also published the notorious collateral murder video, which documented how in 2007, a U.S. Army Apache helicopter gunship targeted and fired on unarmed civilians in Baghdad. At least 18 civilians were killed. They included 2 Reuters reporters and a man who came to rescue the wounded. 2 children were injured. Then a U.S. Army tank drove over one of the bodies, severing it in half. That video contains evidence of 3 separate war crimes that are prohibited by the Geneva Conventions and the U.S. Army Field Manual. As several civil liberties and human rights organizations declared in October 2021, when they asked Garland to dismiss the case against Assange, his prosecution poses a significant threat to First Amendment freedom of the press. The UK's decision to extradite Julian Assange to the nation that plotted to assassinate him, the nation that wants to imprison him for 175 years for publishing truthful information in the public interest, is an abomination wrote Noam Chomsky, Daniel Ellsberg, and Alice Walker, co-chairs of Assange defense, in reaction to Patel's extradition order. The U.S. government argues that its venerated constitution does not protect journalism the government dislikes and that publishing truthful information in the public interest is a subversive criminal act. This argument is a threat not only to journalism but to democracy itself. Trevor Tim, Executive Director of Freedom of the Press Foundation, warned that if Assange is extradited to the United States and convicted of the charges against him, it would potentially make receiving classified information, asking for sources for more information, and publishing certain types of classified information a crime. Tim noted, journalists, of course, engage in all these activities regularly. Moreover, Assange has suffered psychological torture while confined in the UK for more than a decade, according to Nils Meltzer, United Nations Special Rapporteur on Torture. In December 2021, Meltzer tweeted that the UK is literally torturing him to death. On June 10th, more than 300 doctors, psychiatrists, and psychologists calling themselves Doctors for Assange wrote to Patel that Assange's deteriorating health made it medically and ethically unacceptable to extradite him. Julian's 13-year persecution culminates in a decision of ostentatious, callous indifference, John Shipton, Assange's father, told Truthout, adding, "Who amongst us would not burn with indignation and loathing?" Stella Assange, who recently married Julian in prison, called Patel's decision a dark day for press freedom and for British democracy. She told the Associated Press, "Julian did nothing wrong. He has committed no crime and is not a criminal. He is a journalist and a publisher, and he is being punished for doing his job." Yet UK officials disregarded Assange's health and the injustice of his prosecution, insisting that the US would treat him appropriately. In its June 17th statement ordering Assange's extradition, the UK Home Office wrote, "In this case, the UK courts have not found that it would be oppressive, unjust, or an abuse of process to extradite Ms. Assange, nor have they found that extradition would be incompatible with his human rights, including his right to a fair trial and to the freedom of expression, and that whilst in the US, he will be treated appropriately, including in relation to his health." But after a three-week evidentiary hearing, UK District Judge Vanessa Baritzer ruled in January 2021 that if Assange were extradited to the United States, he would likely attempt suicide because of his mental state and the onerous conditions of confinement in US prisons. The United States later came forward with qualified assurances that Assange wouldn't be kept in solitary confinement, and the UK High Court reversed Baritzer's decision in January 2022. The UK Supreme Court affirmed the High Court's dismissal of Assange's appeal in March, paving the way for Patel's decision ordering extradition. Amnesty International Agnes Callamard, former UN Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial Summary or Arbitrary Execution, was skeptical of the so-called assurances that Assange would be treated humanely in US custody. "Diplomatic assurances provided by the US that Assange will not be kept in solitary confinement cannot be taken on face value given previous history," Callamard said, referring to the US reneging on past extradition assurances. Assange now has until July 1st to appeal Patel's decision and apply to the High Court to reverse Baritzer's ruling on the other issues Assange raised on the extradition hearing. Assange will also raise on appeal the CIA's plot to kidnap and assassinate him while he was in the Ecuadorian embassy under a grant of asylum. If Assange loses his appeals to the UK High Court and Supreme Court, he could appeal to the European Court of Human Rights. The appeals could take several months or even years. The indictment against Assange has been assigned to U.S. District Judge Claude M. Hilton, who jailed former U.S. Army intelligence analyst Chelsea Manning in 2019 for refusing to appear before a federal grand jury investigating Assange. The indictment charges that Assange conspired with Manning to gain access to a government computer. This is the first time the United States has prosecuted a journalist or media outlet for publishing classified information. The extradition, trial, and conviction of Julian Assange would have frightening ramifications for investigative journalism. On June 17th, the editorial board of The Guardian wrote, "This action potentially opens the door for journalists anywhere in the world to be extradited to the U.S. for exposing information deemed classified by Washington."
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The leader's viewpoint on Imam Hussein's revolution and Ashura. On the day of Karbala, Hussein ibn Ali alayhi salam and his companions were martyred in an abandoned desert where there was not any friend and where there were many enemies. On that day, his family members were taken captive, and that was over. Today, this event, which should normally have been destroyed and consigned to oblivion after 10-15 days, is still prominent. Even after the passage of many centuries, the name of Hussein ibn Ali alayhi salam is shining like the sun, and it is enlightening hearts and offering guidance not only among millions of Shias and other Muslims in different Islamic countries, but also among non-Muslims.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
On the day of Ashura, Zainab al-Kubra salamullah alayha watched many of her dear ones go to the battlefield to get martyred. She watched Hussein ibn Ali alayhi salam, Abbas, Ali al-Akbar, Qasim, her children, and other dear ones go to the battlefield. After they were martyred, she went through all those pains. The invasion of the enemy, disrespect, and the responsibility to take care of the surviving children and women. Is it possible to compare the enormity of this tragedy with physical pain? But when she was faced with these difficulties, Zainab al-Kubra did not tell God to save her. She did not say, "Oh, my Lord, save me," while the shredded body of her brother lay in front of her eyes. Tells God, "Oh God, accept this sacrifice from us." When she was asked to describe what she had seen, she replied, "I did not see anything but beauty." All those tragedies were beautiful to Zainab al-Kubra because they were from and for God, because they were supposed to promote the word of God. The story didn't just end in the afternoon of Ashura. In fact, since the afternoon of Ashura, a movement started in history, which is still growing and expanding. It will be the same in the future too. Imam Hussein alayhi salam did all in his power to proclaim the word of truth and to save the people. These are some of the traits that a person in general can see and show in the Ashura event.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.